Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is the Sound Elf Option Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. You usually ask me how I am, and so I'm just going to tell you without you asking.
Thank you.
After I read our guest book, I'm perfect. I'm safe.
Exactly. I had the same, like, things are not so bad. I feel great. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. This author has written a very enlightening but good grief scary book. So we're going to have him on. He's absolutely intriguing. He's a CIA whistleblower. He's going to tell us how to get along in jail, and maybe he can tell us how to stay out of jail, because from his book, I have learned that the government can put you in jail for anything they want. They make up stuff. And that's the scary part of it. And I woke up free this morning, so I'm happy. We are being sponsored by the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology and Sound Health. That's the largest alternative health, I guess, institute in Ohio. I don't know what to call us. We are an institution. We're a research facility. We train doctors. We see clients. So look us up on the website, soundhealthoptions.com, and there's going to be lots of information about this show there under radio, but there's also a lot of videos about people we work with. So we invite you all to be part of the projects that we're doing. One of them is fibromyalgia, and we are providing free fibromyalgia evaluations for anyone who thinks they have fibromyalgia, or just for anybody who thinks they want to test themselves or see what it's all about. So go to soundhealthportal.com, and there's several projects up there. There's a nutrition one where you can test your nutrition every day. The one that we are looking at this week is the fibromyalgia one. We're happy to do that as a public service for people. We are working on lipedema. We'll have that up in a week or so. I have the database almost completed. And then by popular request from an international magazine, we are going to be decoding all of the pathogens associated with AIDS. That's a scary one, but we're going to be doing it. We are not simultaneously broadcasting. What other announcements that we just need to get out of the way? Oh, you have some skitter Twitter stuff you talk about, Richard.
Yeah. This is one of those shows. I've read John's book, and John's story is amazing on so many levels, that I know people are going to want to re-listen to this and or share this with their friends. And you can do that easily. You can re-listen about 15 minutes after we end the show. It takes about that amount of time to render. And you can go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and then click on Blog Talk Radio. And the show replay link will be there. There's also a tab for Blog Talk Archives, and the player with the last five shows will be there. You can also go to any of your iTunes-like aggregators, podcast aggregators, depending upon what platform you run on, whether you like Stitcher, which is a free one, which is cross-platform, which is easy to not only listen to and follow shows you want to listen to. You can go to Stitcher or iTunes or Pocket Cast or Dog Catcher, or I could probably just do a show of, you know, podcast player titles for an hour. And search for Sherry Edwards and find just about 500 shows. I think we just peaked over 500 shows. So they're all there, and this one will be at the top of the list. And it's easy to do. Don't be afraid, everybody, especially Stitcher is free. So I recommend those highly. You
have
another announcement, Sherry, I can tell.
Yeah. I just looked at the stats for our show, Richard. We've had over 250,000 listeners. Does that just flabbergast you?
I try not to think about it. I can peak sort of at thinking about talking to maybe 10,000 people, but 250,000, that's like mind-blowing.
I think it's because we are really for the public. We don't put a lot of commercials in here. We do this because we love it and we love our audience. And there's a chat, by the way, up on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to ask you to chime in and answer a question. But first I want to tell you that we have another two-day free class. We've been doing this for 2 years now. It's on May 11th and 12th. But we've changed the format somewhat. We used to charge $1,200 for this class because that's how much all the computer and equipment cost us. And now we've paid for the computer things. So if you pay us $300 to take this two-day course, we're going to provide you a microphone and five softwares that you can use for a year. If you take the free portion of it, you only get to use them for 30 days, and then you have to start paying for them. And if you pay us the $300, which really pays our expenses, we're going to give that back to you when you take our larger class that is really designed for you to set up a bioacoustic center in your community. Now, how many of you can take a free class? You have to buy a microphone if you don't pay us. And set up a business that you could make $30 to $50 an hour. So that's the incentive for all of you left brain, entrepreneurial, money-making kind of people. But for the right-brained people, it's going to be your job to test your community and keep it in good working order, because bioacoustics is predictive. And even if it's helping somebody find the right job, that software is free, the NanoVoice, on our website. So we think you have a right to know about your own perceptions, the perceptions of others. We just did Donald Trump again. We just did his health issues. We just did Nunez and what his real intentions are about the intelligence community. So you can do that too, and that's all of these videos that Richard is talking about. They're all demos on how to use our software to look at pre-vaccination risk, to look at heart, to look at your eyes, to look at seizures, to look at Parkinson's. We just did a big Parkinson's project, and most of the people coming in here that are diagnosed with Parkinson's really don't have Parkinson's. The guy we just did last week really had tetanus. So that's the kind of thing that we can provide from our research facility. I think that is the last of my soapbox. do you have any community announcements before we start with our very special guest, scary guest?
John is not actually scary, although he could be, but considering his training, I think he could probably be fiercely scary. I do have actually, this is in the world community. I've been trying to have more positive actions that are happening in the world, whether it be, and this is of course environmental again. This is about the title of the article is Colombian Community Resistance Defeats Mining Giant, and the company will leave the country. So a group of people in Colombia got together, and they voted to ban this mining operation that wanted to come and, you know, pillage their area. And they actually got together as a group, about 10,000 people, and forced this giant beast of a mining company that was going to come shred their world for gold to end, you know, 14 years of exploration. I mean, they actually got together and got organized and voted and convinced the government. And now this group, they say we're not through, we're going to, you know, all that kind of stuff. But currently they're banned. That's the bottom line. You know, I'm seeing more of this kind of action happening. We just had the big, you know, march protest on Saturday. We've had Earth Day. Solar energy is coming up. You know, there are things where we're really getting together, not just in the United States, but in other locations, and saying, look, no, you're not, no, taking back our power. It's an amazing thing. And it fits right in with what Sherry's talking about with something like the Nano Voice. It's an amazing piece of software that we can use to take our power back so that we're not relying on someone else. When we need them, they can be there, but we can actually begin to take care of ourselves, just like this group in Colombia kicked out this mining operation. We can use Nano Voice to really take care of our own health and manage things in a way that, you know, really look like, oh, that's something weird. I should look into that ourselves. We don't have to go to somebody. We can actually begin to take care of ourselves and our planet. Damn it. Okay.
Yeah, and who's buying and who's spin?
Yeah.
We the people, that's where we're coming from. I think one of the most fantastic things that we've done here at the center is to put out a software that will test people from Fukushima radiation and what to do about it nutritionally. And all of that's on our website under downloads for free. And Richard helped us put that one together.
That was a great experience. At first it was an experiment when Fukushima happened. Sherry said, would you be willing to try the software that she'd put together? And I would take a vocal print every morning, meaning just a recording of my voice, and run it through the software. Or send it actually in the very early stages and send it to Sherry, and she would run it through the software. And she would give me back a report that would show what was elevated, whether, let's say, cesium was elevated or one of the other radioactive materials, because I live in the Pacific Northwest, and we were getting exposed first. And I would then, at that time, there was a chart that showed me supplements or foods that I could take that would help counterbalance that. And then I would test myself or send Sherry my vocal print about an hour after I did that and see if I needed to do more. And it was so empowering to be able to have that, not be freaking out. I mean, I was freaking out anyway. But I mean, to have that as a tool, it's, you know, having like the back to the Nano Voice. I mean, having the Nano Voice on your computer, it's an amazing thing.
And those are free for you to download and use. And there's textbooks there and information and videos. That's another public service from the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology.
Okay, we're ready for this adventure, Sherry?
We are. I was going to give a survey question, but I think I'll wait.
Okay. Our guest today is John Kiriakou. On February 28, 2013, after pleading guilty to violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, I didn't know that was an act, John Kiriakou began serving a 30-month prison sentence. His crime? Blowing the whistle on the CIA's use of torture on Al-Qaeda prisoners. Doing time like a spy is Kiriakou's memoirs of his 23 months in prison. Using 20 life skills he learned in the CIA operational training, he was able to keep himself safe and at the top of the prison social heap. Including his award-winning blog series, Letters from Loretto, Doing Time Like a Spy is at once a searing journal of daily prison life and an alternately funny and heartbreaking commentary on the federal prison system. And that's all true. I read the book. It's like, it is everything that's, it really is an amazing thing. And I'm going to read just a brief quote off of John's website, johnkiriakou.com. The title of this is A Badge of Honor. I am wearing my conviction as a badge of honor. I am proud that I stood up to our government. I stood up for what I believed was right, conviction or no conviction. I am not a criminal. I'm a whistleblower. The thing that blew the whistle on is now law of the land. Torture is illegal. And it's officially abandoned in our country, and I'm proud to have had a role in that. John Kiriakou. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I loved your book. It was so enlightening and scary and funny all at the same time.
Thank you so much.
For people who are having difficulty with this name, Kiriakou, Is that how
O-U.
You... O-U.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, even I can't get it right. So if they go to your site, then it's just John Kiriakou, K-O-U at the end, K-I-R-I-A-K-O-U. And there are some commentaries there, and even in the book, that are so heartfelt, but scary. And one of the things, the most memorable thing in your book to me was this man that they went after, and he refused to testify. So they threatened his grandmother and his son because they lived in the same house, and made him bow down by threatening his family. How would you tell that story, and how often is that used?
Oh, yes. To answer your second question first, this is used every single day in the American judicial system. And this is part of the reason why the federal government wins 98.2% of its cases, according to ProPublica. This was a cellmate of mine who, to make a long story short, had inadvertently accessed a secure government database. When I say inadvertently, I mean because he had won a government contract, but his personnel officer had forgotten to put him on the security list. But when he called to get the password, he was given the password. So they charged him with unauthorized access to a secure database, which is a felony, believe it or not. Well, he said, listen, this was a mistake. I thought my security officer had put me on the contract. It was an oversight, and I didn't do anything wrong. They said, well, we're offering you 9 months in prison. You're in, you're out, you never do it again. And he said no, because if he took a guilty plea, he would lose his security clearance and really lose his ability to make a living. Well, he so angered them by not taking a plea that they started digging into his past. And what they found was that he and his wife had gone to a car dealership a couple of years before because his wife needed a new car. She picked the car she wanted. She wanted it in a different color, so instead of buying it off the lot, they ordered it. In the meantime, he and his wife owned a home in England. She was British, and so she went back to England to get the house ready for the summer. In the meantime, the car dealer calls, his name is Dave, and says, your car's ready. He goes to pick it up. He signs the contract. They said, where's your wife? She needs to sign the contract too. He said, she's in England. The dealer said, that's okay, just sign her name here. So he signed her name. So they charged him with one count of wire fraud for signing his wife's name, and two counts of aggravated identity theft. And then because the car came with a $1,500 rebate, they also charged him with wire fraud. So he had been looking at 9 months in prison. He ended up taking a plea to 9 years and 4 months in prison because they said finally, he kept refusing a deal. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. So finally they said, well, your grandmother and your 16-year-old daughter were in the house when you accessed the database. We're going to charge them with being accomplices to accessing the database, and we'll charge them with conspiracy if you don't take a plea. And so he took a plea. And that's how our government works. They do these two other things. One is called charge stacking. Let's say maybe you really do something wrong. You really do commit a crime. Instead of just charging you with that crime, they'll charge you with 5, 10 felonies, right? And they'll add conspiracy and making a false statement and wire fraud and mail fraud and all these what are called throwaway charges. And then they'll make you defend yourself. And after you finally go bankrupt, because believe me, you're going to go bankrupt having to defend yourself against all these charges, they'll come to you and they'll say, all right, we want to offer you a deal. We'll dismiss all of the charges but one if you take a guilty plea. Well, of course you're going to take a guilty plea, because if you go to trial, yeah, you know juries in this country, they're going to find a bologna sandwich guilty. So do you take the deal, or do you risk winning, you know, knowing that you have a 1.8% chance of winning, and if you lose, you're going to spend 20, 30, 40 years in prison. That's charge stacking. Another thing they do is called venue shopping. In my case, and in the cases of other whistleblowers like Jeffrey Sterling, for example, from the CIA, or even Edward Snowden, we're all charged in the Eastern District of Virginia. You don't even have to ever have been in the Eastern District of Virginia. But the Eastern District of Virginia is known as the Espionage Court because no national security defendant has ever won a case there. And so that's where they charge all the national security cases. If there's a judge, for example, who's particularly tough on bank robbers, they'll charge you with bank robbery in his or her district. So that's venue shopping. They charge you in the district where they know they're going to get a guilty verdict and they know they're going to get the stiffest sentence. And that's not justice. That's politics.
Wow. I read that part and it blew my mind then, and hearing you spell it out, it's like just appalling. But I want to redirect slightly for people who aren't familiar with your story. What was your journey to becoming a counterterrorism expert? I mean, you sound like a whistleblower, and I mean that in the most positive of ways. But you really went in and were dedicated to CIA and highly trained.
I was a
sound like a really nice, easygoing guy. Let's have a beer. But I mean,
yeah, that's all part of the job. You know, you have to love people and you have to love being around people, even bad people, because your job is to recruit spies to steal secrets and then to use those secrets so that the CIA analysts can analyze them and provide the policymakers with the top finished intelligence possible. So you really have to ingratiate yourself with people to get them to trust you and to like you to the point where they're willing to commit treason for you in some cases, or to commit espionage for you.
Wow. And were you always inclined this way? I mean, were you affable before you got into being trained by the CIA? Were you always this personality and they just took advantage of it?
Oh, yeah. I like to think my personality hasn't changed. I really do love being around people. I love talking to people. I draw strength from being in groups of people. I've always loved it. When I was in graduate school, I went to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. for both my undergrad and graduate degrees. I got a bachelor's degree in Middle Eastern Studies, and then I stayed at GW to work on a master's degree in legislative affairs, but with a focus on foreign policy analysis. And I was taking a class called The Psychology of Leadership, and it was being taught by an eminent psychiatrist who's still around and practicing, Dr. Gerald Post. He had a PhD in political science, a PhD in psychology, and an MD. And he assigned us a fascinating paper one day. We were supposed to shadow our bosses and write a psychological profile on our bosses. At the time, I was working for a labor union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, at their international headquarters here in Washington. And I worked for a guy who I was a little bit afraid of. He was one of these old school union organizers. He had had his back broken during a strike one time. Just a big, mean, tough guy. And we didn't necessarily get along very well. He wasn't really my cup of tea, but I was shadowing him for the week. And then halfway through the week, we had an argument, and I called him a racist, which he was. And he got so angry, his face got red, and he balled up his fist. And I remember putting my hands up and recoiling a little because I thought, well, for sure, here it comes. He's going to punch me. And instead, he exploded, and he shouted, "My penis is bigger than yours." And I said, I said, "You're nuts," and I quit, and I walked out. And I wrote my paper, and I did not say in the paper that I had quit, but I said that my conclusion was that he was a sociopath with psychopathic tendencies, and he was potentially violent. So a week later, I get the paper back, and my professor had written a note in the column. He gave me an A, And he wrote, "I've never done this before, but I urge you to quit this job. I agree with your assessment that your boss is a sociopath with psychopathic and violent tendencies. Please see me after class." So I went up to him after class, and I said, "Dr. Post, did you want to see me?" "Yes," he says, "come to my office." So I go to the office. He closes the door, and he says, "Look, I'm not really a professor here. I'm a CIA officer undercover as a professor here. And I'm looking for people who might fit into the CIA's culture. I think you would fit into the CIA's culture. Would you like to work for the CIA?" Now, of course, that's illegal today. We have equal employment opportunity laws in this country. But this is the proverbial old boy network. And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to work for the CIA." And so I started going through the motions of a battery of tests, you know, written, psychological, medical, polygraph, a comprehensive background investigation, and 8 months later, I was working at the CIA.
Wow. And what happened to the legislative part? Is that sort of, do you think that's part of your background to, I mean, you seem, and from your story, we will get into talking about prison, but I mean, you seem like a kind of a rabble-rousing organizer, even though you have this affable, you know, nice guy. But, I mean, you do have that undertone of, you know, you seem like you want to be a change maker and have people pay attention to truth.
Well, my wife says that I never saw a bridge I didn't want to burn, which I think is not entirely fair. But, you know, the older I get, I do tend to see more things in terms of black and white, sure. At the CIA, we're taught that everything is a shade of gray. And I've concluded that that's just simply not true. Some things are right and wrong. And in my case, torture was wrong. It was wrong. It was illegal, and it was morally and ethically wrong. And I decided to take a stand on it.
And when did torture float up into your view? I mean, how did that become, again, let's, for the backstory for people, this was part of, you know, this is why you went to jail, was because
right.
they, as I will say, you'll have a different way of saying it, you know, they came after you for like disclosing this information about torture, that you had a
right.
position. When did that float into your view, and why did you take such a strong position?
Well, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, I became the CIA's chief of counterterrorism operations in Pakistan. And in that job, I led a series of raids in March of 2002 that resulted in the capture of Abu Zubaydah. And I'm not allowed to say the number, but many dozens of al-Qaeda fighters. Abu Zubaydah, we believed at the time, was the number three in al-Qaeda. And this was the highest-ranking terrorist capture that we had ever made to that point. So I finished that tour in the early summer of 2002. I went back to headquarters, and a senior officer in the CIA's counterterrorism center asked me if I wanted to be what he called certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. I had never heard the term before. So I asked him what he meant. He explained what these techniques were, and I said, "Wow," I said, "that sounds like a torture program to me. I don't think I'm interested, but let me think about it for an hour." So I went up to the CIA's executive floor, the seventh floor, and there was a very, very senior CIA officer for whom I had worked in the Middle East about a decade earlier, and I went to ask him his advice. And he said, "First, this is a torture program. They can use whatever euphemism they want, but this is a torture program. Secondly, torture is a slippery slope, and you know how some of these guys are. Somebody's going to go overboard, and they're going to kill a prisoner. And when that happens, there's going to be a congressional investigation, and then there's going to be a Justice Department investigation, and somebody's going to go to prison. Do you want to go to prison?" And I said, "No, I don't want to go to prison." As things turned out, I was the only one who went to prison, but I said, "No, mm-hmm. no, I don't want to go to prison." So I went back downstairs, and I told the counterterrorism officer, "This is a torture program. I'm not interested." Well, it turned out they had asked 14 people if they wanted to go through the training, and I was the only one who said no. So that was in June of 2002. On the 1st of August 2002, we started torturing Abu Zubaydah at a secret prison overseas. And I kept my mouth shut. I kept my mouth shut from 2002 until December of 2007. And then finally, Brian Ross of ABC News asked me to answer some questions. He said he had a source who said that I had tortured Abu Zubaydah. I said that was absolutely untrue. I was the only person who was kind to Abu Zubaydah. I never tortured him or any other al-Qaeda prisoner, ever. And he said, well, and this is an old reporter's trick, he said, well, you're welcome to come on the show and defend yourself. In the meantime, President Bush gave a press conference that very same week in which he looked right into the camera and he said, we do not torture. And I knew that was a lie. That was a bald-faced lie. And then later in the week, in response to a reporter's question, he said, well, if there is torture, it's the result of a rogue CIA officer. And I said to my wife, Brian Ross's source is at the White House, and they're going to try to pin this on me. And I decided that I would do that interview, and that whatever he asked me, I was going to tell the truth. I believed that program was wrong, and it was illegal, and I was going to tell the truth. And I did. Well, within 24 hours, the FBI started investigating me, and they investigated me for a full year. And then in December 2008, they closed the case and said that I had not committed a crime. What I did not know was that 3 weeks later, when President Obama was inaugurated, the CIA asked the Justice Department to reopen the case against me secretly. And they did. And they investigated me for another 3 years. And then they finally charged me with 5 felonies in January of 2012.
Wow. You've also talked about a difference in, I'll call it style, but that seems so bad when we're talking about torture or interrogation. Is there a difference in style between that lean toward torture in the CIA versus how the FBI...
Oh, yes. Yes,
you
yes.
know, interrogate
dramatic
something?
Dramatic difference.
Yeah, talk about that, would you please?
You bet. The FBI has been doing custodial interrogations since the end of the Second World War. They've been doing them since the 20s, but they've been doing them in this certain style since the end of the Second World War when they were interrogating Nazi prisoners of war. And this style is actually quite simple. It's that you sit across the table from your prisoner, you establish a rapport with him or a relationship. Maybe you offer him a cigarette or a piece of fruit, or you ask him how his family's doing. And although this may be time-consuming, over a period of time, he's going to eventually open up to you. And the FBI, and they've done this for generations, the FBI is actually very successful in getting people to talk this way. Well, at the CIA, we had no history in interrogations. And we subscribed at the time to this ticking time bomb theory that something terrible is going to happen and the clock is ticking and we really need to get the information to disrupt the next attack. So George Tenet, who was the CIA director at the time, convinced President George W. Bush to remove the FBI from the secret prison location and to turn Abu Zubaydah's interrogation over to the CIA. President Bush did that, and within hours we began torturing him. He immediately clammed up and gave us no actionable intelligence, nothing. The actionable intelligence that Abu Zubaydah provided, he provided to the FBI before the torture started. It was an utter failure.
And it leaves me slightly speechless. Don't they understand that? I mean, why is there still this sort of the thuggery attitude that torture works when it demonstrates that it doesn't? And you also talk in the book about that also when you're torturing somebody or somebody's being tortured, they'll say anything.
Anything.
So they could just
anything.
Be spewing out any kind of information. They could be reciting the alphabet. They could be giving you all sorts of names. They're just saying
just
anything
to
make the torture
torturing.
Stop. Yeah.
Yes. And then you're going to have to tie up a team of analysts to pour through all this nonsensical information to see what's true, what's false, and what's actionable. So you actually waste more time by torturing the prisoner. Yeah, I say all the time, too, the reason why there's still this drumbeat from former CIA officers at the very highest levels who were involved in the torture program is because this is their legacy. I mean, these are men and women who have devoted their entire adult lives to the CIA and to the national security, and they made this one terrible mistake by implementing this torture program. So because it's their legacy, they have to double down. When their obituaries are written, their obituaries are going to say that they were responsible for this abomination in policy. And so they have to double down and keep repeating the lie that it worked over and over and over again to try to convince the American people that it's true.
Oh, so you've committed there. It's like lying. You have to commit to the lie. And once you're enrolled in the story of the lie, you have to keep perpetuating the lie to a certain extent.
Okay, can you imagine a former CIA director saying, you know what? It was a mistake. My bad. I'm sorry. No, I mean, that'll never happen. Never, ever happen.
I can't imagine anybody in government actually saying that. Oh,
no.
My bad. I made a mistake. Let's move along. That's not happening. So let's talk about your jail time. Oh, my God. Your jail time. It's an amazing – I can't wait until it turns into a TV series. I don't know if it actually could. It's pretty it's
from
pretty
your
gnarly.
Lips to God's ears.
It's pretty – I mean, it's really an amazing – you do have a dark sense of humor, I guess I would call it, because it is – I mean, the thing about how the book is – how you talk about it is it's so – you describe it so well because of your training. That's why I really wanted to talk a bit about your training, because you really describe people so well because you've been trained to observe people. I mean, like you said, you like people to begin with. You like hanging out with people. But I think you didn't think during any of your training that you end up in jail time using these skills.
Certainly not. And, you know, in my sentencing, my attorneys asked the judge to send me to a minimum security work camp. And the judge agreed and the prosecutors agreed. And so in a minimum security work camp, there are no bars on the windows, the doors are not locked, you can work in town, and you're kind of on your honor to not abscond. You know, you're supposed to come back and make sure you sleep there in your bunk. So when I got to the prison, I turned myself in. You literally just go knock on the door and say, "Hi, I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to turn myself in." And so the corrections officer, or CO, starts leading me back around to the back of the actual prison, which is across the street from the camp. And I said, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp. And he laughed and he said, not according to my paperwork, you're not. So I told myself, just take it easy. There's nothing you can do. If you make a scene, you're going to go to solitary. So I just tried to relax. And 5 days later, I got access to a telephone. And I called my lawyer and I said, hey, they put me in the actual prison with the pedophiles and the murderers and the drug kingpins. And he said, oh, my God, I'm sorry. He said, well, we can file a motion, but it'll be 2 years before we get a hearing and you'll be home by then. He said, I'm sorry, buddy, you're going to have to tough it out. And so I decided that day that I was going to rely on my CIA training and make sure that I could protect myself. And so that's what I did.
Wow, you're going to have to tough it out. Whoa.
Not what I wanted to hear. Let me tell you.
This is not how we think of, you know, in the movies, this is not how the legal system works. You don't have your attorney say, oh, you're going to have to tough that out. Get back, you know, see you in 30 months. That's
and, you know, I figured out later how it happened, why it happened. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request on myself. And they sent me back 255 pages, and almost all of it was just nonsense. It was my medical records and my visitors list and just silly stuff. But there were 8 pages in there that were clearly stamped at the top and bottom, FOIA exempt, do not release to inmate. And either somebody was really bad at their jobs in the FOIA office at the Bureau of Prisons, or someone felt sorry for me and stuck it in there just so I could get to the bottom of this. And there was one page that had these huge block letters, and it says, caution, inmate has access to the media. And I thought, well, that's what it was. That's what it was. And then there was another one. It was a memo from the warden to all the guards telling them to be especially careful around me because I was so highly trained and I had ready access to the press. and they wanted to keep me away from the press. Well, the irony of that is, if they had sent me to the camp, I would have minded my own business, I would have kept my mouth shut, kept my head down, I would have done my 23 months, and I would have gone home. Because they screwed me and stuck me in the prison, I was determined to tell my story. And so that's exactly what I did.
Wow. and I mean, that is, let's spend time talking about the prison time, because that's really amazing. I hadn't even thought about that angle after now adding that in. Is really true that they pissed you off. I mean, they put you in a position of wanting to be pissed off.
You know what? It was energizing. It gave me something to look forward to. The worst thing about prison, I mean, besides the obvious, the violence and the loneliness, it's the boredom. It's Groundhog Day every single day. You get up, you eat, you watch TV, you walk around the track. There's nothing to do. And people actually go crazy. I read a study saying that 85% of people in American prisons suffer from some kind of mental illness, and that's certainly exacerbated once you're inside. So, you know, you have to keep yourself from going crazy. Well, one of my attorneys asked me before I went in if I would write an open letter to my supporters. There were something like 600 people who had signed up for an email list saying that they just wanted to hear how I was doing. So she said, when you feel comfortable, write a letter. I'll scan it and send it around to the email list. And I said, okay. And I waited about 6 weeks before I did that. 8 weeks, maybe. And so I wrote it, and I included two things in this letter, which I call the letter from Loretto. Two things that I had no idea really how important they were when I was writing them. In fact, I was exposing a federal crime that had been committed against me by two of the guards. I just figured, well, I'm in prison. There's nothing I can do. The guards are going to mess with me. This is just prison life. Well, in fact, they had committed this crime. So I wrote this letter, and I sent it to my attorney. She gave it to Jane Hampshire, who was maintaining the list. Jane ran a website called firedoglake.com. Well, I didn't realize that Jane was close friends with Arianna Huffington. And when she received it, she sent the letter to Arianna, and Arianna put it on the Huffington Post, and it went completely crazy. I ended up getting more than 1 million hits with that first letter, and the warden ended up getting requests from CNN, MSNBC, 60 Minutes, the BBC, and then the newspapers began calling, and by the end of the week, it was in the magazines, it was in The Economist and Playboy and The Atlantic Monthly and Time Magazine. And so I established myself right off the bat as the enemy of the prison administration. I had far more trouble with the guards and the prison administrators than I did with other prisoners.
Isn't that amazing? You talk about that somewhat. I was going to ask you about that. Were you actually, I don't think you were ever afraid. I mean, you're kind of a big guy to begin with. Aren't you? Aren't you six something? Okay. So you're already physically imposing.
Yep.
Yeah. You're physically imposing and you're trained to do bad things.
Yes.
That's all I'm going to say. You're really trained.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that first time I was called into the cop's office, I had been in prison for like 5 days, and I had been told to dread being called to the lieutenant's office. And I was on the track, walking around the track with a guy, and I hear my name, Kiriakou, report to the lieutenant's office. And I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't done anything. But I gave this guy my home phone number, and I said, if I'm not back in 15 minutes, call my wife and tell her I'm in solitary. So I went to the lieutenant's office. I walk in there. And they've got a copy of my book on the desk, and they have copies of DVDs that I've appeared in, documentaries that I've appeared in on the desk, and they have another prisoner's photograph up on one of the computer screens. So one of the cops says, do you know this guy? And I said, I don't know him. I met him last night. And he said, well, what'd you say to him? And I said, well, we were speaking in Arabic, and I said, Tasharaf bimariftak, it's nice to meet you. Well, what did he say to you? I said, he said, Ana Sharaf Bimariftek, and it's nice to meet you too. And then what? I said, then I walked away. Well, after you met this guy, he called a number in Pakistan, and they told him to kill you. And I said, come on. I said, I could kill this guy with my thumb. Well, no, don't do that, the cop says. We've been looking for a reason to ship him out. He's the uncle of the Times Square bomber. And I said, oh, okay. I said, all right. Okay, thanks for the heads up. Well, I left. So every time I'd pass this guy in the hall, I'd give him the stink eye, and he'd give me the stink eye. But the more I thought about this, the less sense this made. The Times Square bomber and the uncle of the Times Square bomber were Pakistani, and Pakistanis don't speak Arabic. And this guy was an Iraqi Kurd and only spoke Arabic. So that didn't make any sense to me. And I thought, well, why would an Iraqi Kurd call a number in Pakistan? That doesn't make any sense either. He would call a number in Iraq or in an Arab country. So finally, I saw him outside, and I approached him, and I put my hands up just to show that I didn't mean him any harm. And I said, hey, let me ask you a question. After we met, did the cops say anything to you about me? And they said, yeah. He said, they told me that after we met, you called a number in Washington, and they told you to kill me. So
wow.
I told him, well, they told me that you called a number in Pakistan and they told you to kill me. And we kind of laughed about what ham-handed morons these two were. So I went to the law library and I looked this up. And this is a federal crime. It's a Class D felony. It's conspiracy to incite violence in a federal facility. So I wrote this up in the first letter from Loretto. Well, the warden finally approached me when this thing went viral, and he promised me that he would do an investigation. But in fact, the investigation was of me and how I got access to the press. And so what they did is they began monitoring every single one of my phone calls for the rest of the time I was in prison. They monitored my incoming and outgoing mail. They deployed rats. They transferred rats into my cell to rat me out, to tip off the cops when I was planning to do another letter from Loretto. And they put a 5-day delay on my emails coming in and out so they could monitor all of it. But all that did was energize me. I never gave up.
Well, at what point, when did you click into CIA mode, meaning you talk about things being operational thinking?
Yes.
Talk about operational thinking, and when did that click in for you? Were you in shock when you went into jail?
Oh,
I mean,
yes,
you were in shock. You
I
were
was.
In shock, but when did you the light switch go on and you moved into operational mode, and what is that?
It took me about a week before I got into operational mode. Anytime somebody goes to prison, you're in shock, at least for the first couple of weeks. You can't believe that you're there. It's just such a completely alien place and alien state of mind. And prison's the last place I ever expected to find myself. So for the first week, I was pretty well in shock. And I told myself on the very first day just to keep a low profile, don't talk to anybody, get the lay of the land. Well, when I was being processed in, the only thing that the cop said to me was if someone enters your cell uninvited, that's an act of aggression. So sure enough, I'm in prison for something like 2 hours, and two neo-Nazis walk into my room. One has an enormous swastika that takes up the entire front half of his neck. And I jump up and I put my fists up and I said, what do you want? And the big one says, take it easy. Are you the new guy? I said, yeah. He said, are you a fag? I said, no. Are you a rat? I said, no, I didn't have anybody in my case. Are you a chomo? I said, I don't know what that word means. He goes, chomo, child molester. I said, no, I'm not a child molester. And he said, okay, just give us a copy of your paperwork and you can sit with the Aryans in the cafeteria. And I thought, oh, my God, okay, well, I guess I'm with the Aryans now. And then about 5 days later, two members of the Nation of Islam walked into my cell. And again, I jumped up and put my fists up. And one of them, like, very gingerly hands me a newspaper. It was the Nation of Islam newspaper. And he said, just wanted to tell you that Reverend Farrakhan says you're a hero of the Muslim people and you're not going to have any trouble with us. And I said, oh, okay. So I have the Aryans, I have the Nation of Islam, and four of my cellmates when I first got there were members of various Mexican drug gangs, very violent, murderous Mexican drug gangs. And I helped one of them write an appeal. And so he put out the word to the Mexicans that that I was okay. So I knew that I knew early on that I wasn't going to have to deal with violence. And so with that aside, I decided to start thinking about myself and my own comfort.
And when did you tell some amazing stories about how you profiled people. So you took your skills, you know, it seems like your skills began to, you know, float to the top once you got through the shock.
Yes.
And you profiled people without any of the bad words, because there are some bad words in this book. I'm warning you.
Yeah.
We're
sorry
in jail,
about that.
People.
I told my
We're
kids not they're not allowed to read it.
We're not kidding around. We're in jail. And so you set up an officer, a mean CO, you know, and so you profiled that person. And, you know, tell that story. That, I mean, because that really shows, you know, a combination of training and you know, thinking, which I think is this operational mode, that you go through the process of really learning the deal, her deal, and then setting her up, you know, with harm to none. I mean, no actual harm. But, I mean, you, like, moved her. It's an amazing
yeah.
thing. Tell that story.
I got her transferred, actually. Am I allowed to swear on this show or no?
Not so much.
Okay, the language is very blue. I won't use the language. You can read it in the book. There was a female CO about my age. I'm 52 now, who was in my housing unit. And I say in the book, this woman had a look. You may have heard people describe some women as having been ridden hard and put away wet. And that's how this woman looked. She was just ragged and covered in tattoos, poorly done tattoos, and she was just a bitter, angry, three-time divorced, mean person. So she was in charge of the afternoon shift in my housing unit, and she would do mail call every day at 4 o'clock. She could never pronounce my name. She would butcher it. And I think it was on purpose. She did it just to be disrespectful and to try to humble me. So finally, I was walking to dinner one night, and she stops me, and she says, "Are you the MF-er whose name I can't pronounce?" And I said, "Kiriaku." And she says, "How about if I just call you F-Face?" And I walked away. And the guy I was walking with said, "Classy." And I said, "White trash is more like it." But she heard me call her white trash. And so after dinner, she and another CO shook me down. Not just me, but everybody in my cell. They threw our food all over the floor. They threw the pictures I had of my children and stepped on them, clothes everywhere. And that was my very first shakedown. And I wrote about this in my first letter from Loretto. This was one of the two incidents, with the other being the Pakistani, you know, Iraqi Kurd. And so when this appeared in the Huffington Post and went viral, I'm called again to the lieutenant's office. And they said that they needed to take a statement from me. So I said, "Okay, I'll give you a statement." "Well, what happened when she called you these names?" So I told them the story. Well, in fact, in the days before being called to the lieutenant's office, I had gone back down to the law library. I was a regular down there. And I looked up the regulations, the Internal Bureau of Prisons regulations, on abusive language. And it is clearly, clearly prohibited for corrections officers to speak to prisoners that way. The first offense is a warning. The second offense is 14 days without pay. And the third offense is firing. So I put my right hand in the air, and I swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and I laid out the entire story. Well, pending investigation, they transferred her to a Jeep outside the compound, where her job for the next 6 months was just to drive in these giant circles around the compound and make sure nobody was trying to escape. So I got some real satisfaction for 6 months. that enraged her, and we had a couple of confrontations in the months that followed. But I got right back into her face and told her, I'm not afraid of you. You can't do anything to me. You can't hurt me. They're watching you more than they're watching me. And she backed down each and every time.
Well, I bet. Go ahead, Sherry.
Go ahead. I want to ask a question that's better left at the end, but we only have 6 minutes, so we may go over.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go ahead, Richard?
I was just going to say, you know, there's a number of stories. I mean, so was there anybody in your jail time that you actually were afraid of or feared for your life?
That's a really good question. No. There were people who were incredibly dangerous. I tell one story about a man who was probably a serial killer of prostitutes in the West. They couldn't get him on the murders, so they got him on multiple rape charges instead. This was in the days before DNA. He had done 20 years, and then they gave him another 20 on gun charges, felon with a gun charges. So altogether, he got 40 years, although they just couldn't nail him on these multiple murders out in Colorado. He was a psychopath and a very dangerous and violent one. And, yeah, I always sort of slept with one eye open when he was around. There were a couple of contract killers that I came into contact with, and it wasn't very friendly contact. But, you know, I ended up cultivating a very close relationship with the Italians in prison. And when I say the Italians, I mean Italians named Gambino, Colombo, Lucchese, Bonanno. And we had a really great relationship. I consider myself still to be friends with them. Once I became a part of that Italian community, everybody else in the place knew it was hands off.
So that's advice for anybody coming into prison?
The easy answer to that is, yeah, read this book. You know, this doesn't have to be the nightmare that you think it might be. Be true to yourself. Take care of yourself. Think about yourself. Make strategic relationships, and otherwise keep your mouth shut.
There's a lot of good advice for anybody doing something they think they might be put through the system about. There's great advice in here. But I have question that I don't exactly know how to put. But when you talk about this, what I get from your voice is this is something over here removed that you're going to use for a purpose. Like the story happened to you, but it's not relating to you now. So have you let go of that past and you see it as something that you're going to use to get through? Are you moving forward? What's happening to you?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I've put this all behind me. This was an aberration in my life. And writing about it and talking about it has been therapeutic. So, yeah, so many people come out of prison with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I don't feel like I have any of that. It almost feels like a dream, like it really didn't happen to me. So I think that's healthy. Yeah, I have moved on. As soon as I got out, I was hired by a think tank here in Washington to write about counterterrorism issues, intelligence reform, and most importantly, prison reform. I've got a syndicated weekly column that runs on readersupportednews.org. And most importantly, I've been able to parlay many of these stories into television options. I've sold 3 TV series in Hollywood in the 2 years since I've been home. They're in various stages of development, but I think that's really what my future is, television.
That explains what I'm hearing out of your voice. I want everybody to know that your book is coming out May 11th. They can pre-order on probably any of the big guys, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Do you have a website that you want people to know about and how
sure,
they can stay
thanks.
In touch with?
Yeah, it's www.johnkiriakou.com. It's JohnKiriakou.com. And let me make one correction. The book is coming out on May 16th. But yes, it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Target and all these other sites. It's Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison.
Well, I love the book because what we do here is being threatened and giving people freedom about their health. So It relieved me a lot of what I may expect and how I can counter it. That the book is so clever in how you countered some of the things that people were trying on you. So,
Thank you so much.
Fascinating. It's entertaining. It's enlightening. It's scary. But it is also a relief to read your
Thank
book.
Thank you very much for that. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Well, and it's such an interesting training manual. I mean, who would have thought that a story about being in prison would give so many – I mean, yes, I mean, you paint amazing characters. I back to what I said at the very beginning, you know, I can see it as a TV series because you paint really great – profiled pictures of people, and I use profiled intentionally, but I mean you really give great descriptions of characters and peoples and how to work with them and handle them and work around them, and you know, to really, I mean, yes, you're a big physically imposing guy, however you really don't get into physical confront very much. It's more like you really go in looking at, oh, he knows him and they're, you know, I mean, you really are observing. And from that observational position, you choose your actions. And it's a great training manual in a certain weird way. I think it's like Cherry said.
Thank you very much.
It's got a lot of room. I wouldn't have thought.
I'm very pleased that you enjoyed it. Very, very happy that you enjoyed it.
You know, about halfway through, I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're going to hear about some other setup. I mean, guys with knives coming at you and the thing and the stuff and the, oh, my God, and now we're doing this and, you know, wow. But as you back up and you in the context of the story, there is, as Sherry just said, there's a lot of great information on the how-to of dealing with, you know, a bureaucracy. That bureaucracy happens to be prison.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very good story. I recommend
Thank
it
you.
Highly.
Oh, I appreciate it very
okay,
much.
I can't believe we're out of time. Wow, that went fast. Yikes. Any other closing thoughts, Sherry?
I'm good. I'm full.
Right. I feel like I need a little piece of angel cake or something light and friendly because it's a great story, but it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, there is, you know, blue language in here, and it's prison life. I mean, it's serious. I had, in other worlds in the restaurant business, I had worked with a number of ex-inmates, and they all, not nearly as articulately as this, but really painted a picture of it is a thing. You're going into a world you won't believe that is developed as it is. And a lot of guys come out with that same, and women that I've known come out with that same thing, that really it's the guards and the COs that are almost scarier than the people you're in with. It's really, it's an amazing world, and it's a great story of it. So thank you so much, John. That was great.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
You bet. All right, everybody. We'll see you on Tuesday. And we're talking about something I can't remember, as we all know. All right, everybody. Have a great rest of the weekend. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Later.